Welcome to Let's Consider the Source. Every week on this program, we discuss the nation's most important and interesting media issues. I'm Bob Mann. A flood tide of filth is threatening to pervert an entire generation. Those are pretty scary words, and they introduce a 50-year-old documentary warning us about the dangers of pornography. Look, our nation has always had an obsession with what's considered obscene and indecent in media. On this program, Let's Consider the Source, we've discussed movie ratings, we've discussed broadcast indecency rules, but not pornography. On this episode, my guest is an author of a new book entitled Perversion for Profit, The Politics of Pornography and the Rise of the New Right. The author is Whitney Strube, Assistant Professor of History at Rutgers University in Newark, New Jersey. Whitney, thank you very much for taking the time to be on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Your title is actually an homage to the very people you're criticizing. Explain what the title is and the origin, because I used the opening line here to scare the audience.
Sure. So Perversion for Profit was a short 1963 film by the anti-porn group Citizens for Decent Literature. You can find it today all over the internet on YouTube or archive.org. And it's basically a propagandistic scare movie, as, you know, your very ominous introductory quote suggested, about the terrors and horrors inflicted on our society by pornography. So I took my title from that, but, you know, I think there's also a play on it going on here, in that there's a sort of perverse irony in that the modern conservative movement has in fact profited greatly from their vision of perversion and a sort of reactionary sexual politics that mobilizes against it very, very effectively in the last 50 years.
How exactly does a battle over pornography advance right-wing politics, though? You say that there's, in the book, huge political capital and moralism. What can right-wing and conservative politicians gain by making pornography or alleged pornography the centerpiece of their political platform?
Well, it's an extraordinarily effective rhetorical tool to mobilize people around, and I think we see that going on, you know, especially in the late 60s, early 70s. I mean, the Nixon administration in particular is just a paragon of this. You know, we know from the paper trail that Richard Nixon left in his presidential papers, which were at the National Archive and I think are now at the Nixon Museum, that, you know, he's very deliberately cultivating a public persona of outrage and indignation over porn and smut, you know, at the very time when he's also explicitly seeking to displace the politics of race and class that the United States had begun to deal with in the 1960s under Lyndon Johnson and the Great Society. And so porn provides this great rhetorical tool. You know, here's a way to rally the public to an issue that seemingly everyone can agree with. It's hard to take a stance against somebody who's taking a stance against pornography. And, you know, meanwhile, you know, can act to sort of displace these other issues by making them less relevant on the political landscape.
So basically, if Debbie Does Dallas is playing in Times Square, you don't have as much attention given to invading Cambodia.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. And Nixon, you know, was very explicit and very cynical about this. I mean, that is exactly what he intended this issue to do. And, you know, his administration, I think, in many ways laid the groundwork for the next 40 years of sexual politics on the right. You know, we see it under Ronald Reagan in the 80s when he forms an attorney general's commission to investigate pornography that has a mandated mission to come to conclusions about its harmfulness before the investigation begins. And you see this, you know, over and over playing out in other social issues as well when it comes to, you know, abortion and gay rights and feminism. And so I think pornography kind of leads the way here in cultivating this particular sexual politics.
We just smacked Nixon around a little bit, but it was in 1970, which was right in the midst of the Nixon administration, his first administration, in which there was a presidential commission which gave what, unless I misread this or misinterpreted it, what you consider to be a fairly reasonable solution to this whole situation by talking about frank sexual education and discussion as being a means of, you know, chasing the boogeyman away and replacing it with rational thought. And that actually came during the Nixon administration. What exactly was the conclusion of that presidential commission?
Yeah, I mean, more or less exactly what you said. You know, there's a lot of historical irony bound up in this, too. The President's Commission on Obscenity and Pornography is a product of the Johnson administration. It's formed in 1967. The truth is, Johnson is not enthused about this at all. It comes out of Congress, but he's saddled with it. And so what Johnson does is mostly appoint a bunch of social scientists into this commission. They spend about 3 years investigating pornography and obscenity, and the overwhelming conclusion that they come to is that there is simply no demonstrable social harm that comes of pornography. There are a lot of myths at the time coming from people like J. Edgar Hoover at the FBI that pornography leads to juvenile delinquency or what's often called sexual deviance, a very, very nebulously defined term, but with obvious ominous overtones. And what the commission finds is that you know, simply is not borne out by the evidence. The reality is, you know, pornography just cannot be shown to have these effects. And what they argue for in their recommendations is simply the decriminalization of obscenity for consenting adults. You know, they don't argue that children should have access to pornography. They don't argue that porn should have a right to the public arena where it can be displayed toward people who don't want to see it. But they argue that, you know, consenting adults who want to either order porn or go to it in the movie theaters, which, you know, then is still the operative framework, that ought to be decriminalized. And basically, the report is a resounding dud politically. You know, it comes out accompanied by 10 volumes of social science research supporting its conclusions. And Richard Nixon basically uses it as a moment to denounce, you know, liberals and social scientists for their perverse ways.
So the fact that it's a presidential commission during his presidency doesn't tie him necessarily to it at all.
No, not at all. Nixon actually loves the commission because it allows him to continue to denounce it. You know, we see private memos from some of his advisors like H.R. Haldeman and John Dean basically saying, string this out as long as you can because you're getting great mileage out of it. You know, continue to denounce this at every moment. And so that's what he does. He spends a good portion of 1970 railing against this commission and its, you know, conclusions that he describes as moral anarchy.
Well, that's at the exact same time as he had Spiro Agnew talking about the nattering nabobs of negativism in terms of the news media at the same time. But I want to jump back on something you mentioned about consenting adults, because I want the audience to be clear here that your book is not advocating all sorts of pornography, that child pornography, anything involving beating or killing or snuff films or anything in which people who are not consenting are involved is not something that you're advocating in terms of any kind of free speech or free expression.
Oh, yeah, absolutely not. You know, certainly I would hope that would be obvious to anybody who takes a look at the book. You know, I think the actual politics of pornography, you know, as a kind of cultural form are incredibly complicated. I mean, I would neither celebrate nor denounce porn as we know it. I think it demands a more nuanced response than that. You know, I think the book is more about the sort of ways that pornography has become utilized as a political discourse, and that's, you know, much easier to sort of roundly condemn simply because, you know, the kind of exploitative quality of it.
We were talking about Richard Nixon, but of course, you know, his administration ended 40 years ago. What is the relevance today? Is the right still using so-called indecency or obscenity? And we'll get into the difference between those two words as the broadcast continues. But is the right still using this? Obviously, Rick Santorum ran into a very unfortunate situation for himself in terms of coming out against indecency because of what ended up becoming the Google search for his name, which we won't enumerate here. But basically, is this still, in your opinion, the position of right-wing politicians to jump on this?
Oh, absolutely, and without question. I mean, if we look at the George W. Bush administration, you know, it comes in after 8 years of Clinton where obscenity prosecutions were really de-escalated. The Clinton administration wasn't that interested in, you know, obscenity or pornography. But under Bush, you know, we do see a re-escalation of obscenity charges for adults. And again, you know, this is very distinct from child porn cases, which, you know, are pursued by Clinton and Obama as well. We're talking about adult obscenity here. So under George W. Bush, we see a bevy of charges, you know, levied at adult pornographers. And, you know, that falls into remission under President Obama, as one might expect. But, you know, anybody who's paying attention to the sort of social politics of the 2012 presidential election might have caught that every single Republican candidate, from Romney to Santorum to, you know, the various other also-rans, pledged to re-escalate adult obscenity cases if they were to be elected. So there's no question that this remains an issue. I think it's fallen a little from, you know, public view in the last few years, but you know, there's certainly a Republican Party eager to re-escalate this issue as soon as they have a chance.
As you know, this program comes from a communication arts department at a college, and so to teach obscenity and indecency in a media class is tough, because I always say indecency is kind of like obscenity light, but basically the Supreme Court has defined obscenity as a prurient interest, anything that is appealing to the prurient. I define prurient as being sex for the sake of sex. How do you define prurient issues or prurient material? It's one of the most awkward words, actually, to spell. P-R-U-I-E-N-T, making it very hard to pronounce. Prurient. What do you consider to be prurient, since that is what the Supreme Court uses to divide, you know, what is just indecent from what is obscene?
Sure. You know, I guess I would call into question the sort of utility of prurience itself as a legal concept. I think obscenity doctrine has gotten bogged down, you know, over the decades and frankly from the start in this bizarre semantic shell game where prurient is used as a kind of catch-all word to describe, you know, whatever is sort of socially impermissible at a given moment. You know, I don't think it has a fixed or stable meaning over time. It's really a value judgment word that purports to have a neutral meaning. And, you know, and I think we can see that playing out all the way back in the 1950s. It's 1957 when the Supreme Court issues the ruling in Roth v. U.S., a pivotal case that lays down the legal definition of obscenity, which more or less remains with us today. It's been tweaked in various ways over the decades, but still undergirds current obscenity doctrine. And William Brennan, the Supreme Court justice who wrote Roth v. U.S., he tried to define prurient, and he didn't do a very good job. If you'd like, I could read you his effort here to define it.
Is that where he says, "I don't know what it is, but I know it if I see it"?
Now, that comes a few years later. That's Potter Stewart in a 1964 case, although certainly indicative of, you know, the futility of trying to define this term legally.
But I would love to hear what they actually are attempting to do to define prurient, because I've never actually seen it.
Sure. So this is William Brennan, and, you know, Brennan is a brilliant justice, and he's smart enough to bury this in a footnote, because I think he recognizes in 1957 that this looks a little ridiculous. So prurience, you know, again, is the defining feature of legal obscenity, but here's how he defines it. He begins, "material having a tendency to excite lustful thoughts." Since that's not particularly helpful, he goes on to say Webster's New International Dictionary from 1949 defines prurient in part as follows: itching, longing, uneasy with desire or longing, of persons having itching, morbid, or lascivious longings, of desire, curiosity, or propensity, lewd. And it just goes on from there.
What's the itching all about?
One does wonder.
I never associated, you know, itching with anything erotic.
I don't think that question has been legally explored over the years, to be quite honest.
Well, you know, we'll deal with the itching in the second half of the program right after this break. You're listening to Let's Consider the Source, our weekly media issues talk show here on SiriusXM Public Radio. I'm Bob Mann. My guest is Whitney Strube. He's an assistant professor of history at Rutgers University in New Jersey, and he has written a book which is entitled Perversion for Profit, The Politics of Pornography and the Rise of the New Right. We'll talk more with Whitney and take a little trip through time in terms of how America has dealt with obscenity and indecency in the media. We're going to take a short break for the primary underwriter of this program, Caldwell College. You're listening to Let's Consider the Source on XM Channel 121, Sirius Channel 205.
If you're considering a career in media, consider Caldwell College. We're located just minutes from New York City, the nation's media capital. But it's what happens on our 70-acre suburban New Jersey campus which is most important. Caldwell's communications department is designed to give you the preparation you need to compete in this constantly changing field. The radio studio used for this national broadcast is the same facility you will use to learn professional-level radio performance and production. Caldwell's primary emphasis is on broadcast journalism, but we also provide great courses in screenwriting, TV production, video editing, and of course, communications theory. One course even allows students to attend discussions with filmmakers, screenwriters, and actors. The full-time faculty is comprised of working media professionals, including Professor Bob Mann, the host of Let's Consider the Source. Go to www.caldwell.edu, then hit the Academics tab for details. Caldwell College, the key to your communications future.
Bob Mann back here with more of Let's Consider the Source. This is our weekly media issues talk show. I certainly hope you follow me on Twitter at Bob Mann Media, B-O-B-M-A-N-N Media, and listen to us every week here on Sirius XM. We are on Sunday night, 7:30 in the East, 4:30 in the West, with a repeat on Mondays. And my guest is Whitney Strube, and he's Assistant Professor of History at Rutgers University in Newark, New Jersey. And we're talking about his book, Perversion for Profit, The Politics of Pornography and the Rise of the New Right. Let's go back in time a little bit. First of all, I'm not going to spend too much time before the 20th century, but give us a little history lesson. Who was Anthony Comstock?
Oh, sure. Comstock was the preeminent smut buster of the late 19th century. Briefly put, he rises to power in the 1870s by denouncing pornography and its various harms. He believes it leads to a downward spiral of lust and death. And he winds up getting an act passed in 1873 in his name, what we remember as the Comstock Act, which is the first meaningful federal obscenity law. In fact, it remains the relevant obscenity law today, banning obscenity from the mails, and he's appointed postal inspector for life and spends the next four decades chasing after anything he considers smut and arresting people.
Let's bring it up to the modern age. After World War II, in the age of the Red Scare, UAC and Joe McCarthy, and you start to see an emergence, first of all, of social realism in film, which gets people very nervous, but you had local censorship boards in those days. Tell the audience what life was like before you had the MPAA, and obviously the Motion Picture Association of America is far from, you know, a cure for all of this, but in my opinion, local censorship boards were much tougher and much more arbitrary and, of course, had regional standards. What were they?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I mean, movies do not have First Amendment protection until 1952. That's when the Supreme Court finally decides that they do, after having decided otherwise during the 19-teens. And so movies are really subject to this dizzying array of local and state-level censor boards. You know, we see state-level censor boards in Ohio, Kansas, New York, kind of scattered around the country. And then meanwhile, we've also got local censorship boards in a multitude of cities. And so they've all got, you know, very, very different standards. It's kind of a nightmare, a distributional nightmare for film studios and filmmakers. So we might see that in New York State, there's a lot of sort of sexual conservatism about movies that, you know, broach the topic of sex. Meanwhile, in Memphis, which is a place that I've written about and talk about a little in the book, race becomes a huge issue. Memphis, you know, sort of located in the Mid-South but very Southern in its racial standards, tends to ban anything that shows black and white interracial contact, not even sexual or romantic. They ban movies like Curly, which is a comedy about kids in a school, but, you know, shows black and white children interacting and playing together, and that sends them into fits of rage. They ban the movie from the city. So we see all of these kind of erratic and uneven censorship patterns playing out, you know, regionally and locally across the country. And that's one of the reasons that, you know, Hollywood does decide to try to supplant this with a centralized board that will engage in censorship preemptively. And that's, you know, in many ways the origins of the MPAA as we know it.
And in 1968, Jack Valenti and the MPAA, which is basically the lobbying organization for the motion picture industry, goes and creates the MPAA rating system, which at least is better. It's not prior restraint censorship. But we've had Kirby Dick on this program, who did the documentary This Film Is Not Yet Rated, in which he says the MPAA is extremely arbitrary. I assume you're familiar with Kirby Dick's work and would be in agreement with him concerning the MPAA?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think Kirby Dick is a great documentarian, and I love his film about the MPAA. And yeah, I agree completely. You know, I think he would probably agree with me that the MPAA is functionally a censorship board. You know, we don't call it that. It doesn't call itself that, and it goes to great, great efforts to prevent the word from being associated with it. But in practice, that's exactly what it's engaged in, you know, censoring films and forcing them to be cut. Now, it doesn't have legal authority, right? It's not technically a governmental organization. It's not technically a First Amendment issue, but, you know, it has economic power behind it and coercion, and studio films cannot play in movie theaters, most theaters, if they, you know, don't have at least an R rating. And so, it's perpetuated patterns of censorship that are deeply problematic and that have historically targeted LGBT representations and sexuality much more stringently than heterosexual ones.
You're listening to Let's Consider the Source. I'm Bob Mann. This is our weekly media issues talk show on SiriusXM Public Radio. And we're talking today with Whitney Strube, and he's written a book which is entitled Perversion for Profit, The Politics of Pornography and the Rise of the New Right. Whitney, you wrote this initially as your doctoral dissertation. Now it's a book. Is this primarily for an academic market? Or since we are broadcasting this nationally, could anyone who's interested in these kind of expression issues and media issues read it simply for their knowledge and pleasure?
I would certainly hope the latter. I did write it as a dissertation in the UCLA History Department, but you know, the process of turning a dissertation into a book is, you know, one of many, many painful revisions. And I really do hope that it's readable. You know, I'm not talking about deconstructive hermeneutics or some other, you know, kind of
well, that's disappointing. What a
shame. I know. Three people in the universe will, you know, be shaking their fists. I really did have an interest in conveying, you know, this fascinating historical narrative. I mean, you know, the history of the politics of porn can't help but be full of, I think, pretty interesting stories. And I did try to flesh out the narrative side. You know, it's a scholarly book, but I think one that, you know, is not alienating, I hope.
You had to say flesh out that.
it's just unavoidable in dealing with this topic, unfortunately.
Let's talk a little bit about at least my conception, which apparently is a misconception. I thought the sexual revolution would have changed all of this, that even though there would be a certain fight against obscenity or indecency or alleged pornography, that at least people wouldn't think that Americans would be weaker against communists because they were reading pornography. But in your opinion, the social revolution, the sexual revolution, did not change all this.
Well, I think it's a complicated question. I mean, in many ways, it clearly did. And in other ways, I think not to the extent that it was revolutionary. You know, I think I would count myself among the group of historians who think the sexual revolution is something of a misnomer in that, you know, standards changed dramatically between the 50s and the 70s, obviously, but not necessarily in a revolutionary way. You know, a lot of the values of privileging heterosexuality and marital sexuality and procreation, I mean, those remained pretty constant. I don't think there was a radical structural shift there. At the same time, without question, I mean, our society did become more permissive, more open, and in that sense, you know, different forms of sexual expression and more graphic and explicit ones, you know, very much entered the mainstream, especially in the 1970s. You know, I think it's the underlying logic of censorship and obscenity that remain unchanged. In other words, the texts that are being targeted change. The logic, though, does not.
What's interesting is anyone listening to this interview might say, well, you know, he's really beating up on Republicans and conservatives, but you do not let Democrats and liberals off the hook in this argument at all.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I don't, you know, my goal is certainly not some kind of, you know, cheap partisan attack. I mean, the book is very critical of the modern right, and, you know, I think rightly so, and I would stand by that. But it doesn't let liberals off the hook. I mean, you know, one of the arguments I make is that the modern Republican family values agenda that we see kind of ascend under Reagan in the 80s is in a lot of ways a product of the liberal sexual politics of the 1950s and 60s. you know, and liberals, you know, remain complacent in the face of this. And, you know, by being complacent, they become complicit. Even to go back to the story of Richard Nixon and the President's Commission, you know, when that report is issued in 1970 and Richard Nixon denounces it, so does Congress. And we see Congress voting 60, the Senate, that is, voting 60-5 to reject the commission report. And so that's Republicans and Democrats. And, you know, I think we see that pattern of a sort of, you know, conservative sexual politics marking modern liberalism from the 50s all the way, in many ways, through the 21st century.
I'm running around chronologically here, but I do want to go back into the 50s. Comic books were actually attacked. I can't imagine comics being anything that would be considered pornographic.
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, you know, the comics of the 50s, the early 50s, are often, I think, surprisingly graphically violent and sexual today. In fact, you know, it's in 1954 that the comics industry adopts its own standards of decency that it then, you know, self-imposes within the industry and sort of cleans things up. And so the modern memory of, you know, the classic age of comics is shaped by that. But, you know, there were a lot of disturbingly violent sexual comics in that era, and it was outrage against that I think in many ways spawned the, you know, subsequent anti-porn panics of the mid-50s. You know, the people who are engaging in this rhetoric are often the same people, like the Democratic Tennessee Senator Estes Kefauver, who's investigating comics in 1953, and then in 1955 has shifted gears and he's investigating pornography.
Very interesting. The whole thing is fascinating, and I certainly hope people will take time to get it and read it. Whitney, who's the publisher?
Columbia University Press.
Okay, the book is entitled Perversion for Profit, The Politics of Pornography and the Rise of the New Right. The author has been our guest right here, Whitney Strube, Assistant Professor of History at Rutgers University in Newark, New Jersey. And he has helped us to get a real grip on the issues of obscenity, indecency, and pornography throughout our history right here on this edition of Let's Consider the Source.
If you're considering a career in media, consider Caldwell College. We're located just minutes from New York City, the nation's media capital. But it's what happens on our 70-acre suburban New Jersey campus, which is most important. Caldwell's communications department is designed to give you the preparation you need to compete in this constantly changing field. For more information, go to www.caldwell.edu. Then click on the Academics tab for more details. Caldwell College, the key to your communications future.
Let's Consider the Source is also a production of Media Educators Association, a not-for-profit organization established to foster a better understanding of the power of media and film in society today. MEA presents the Saturday Morning Film Festival in New York City. Members attend advance preview screenings of new Hollywood, independent, and foreign language films from film festivals around the world. Whenever possible, filmmakers join us for discussions of their projects. For further information, go to mediaeducators.org.
That's it for this edition of Let's Consider the Source. The producer and creator of this program is yours truly, Bob Mann. The co-producer and technical supervisor is Nick Amabil. The associate producer is John Yurko. This program is produced by the Communication Arts Department at Caldwell College in Caldwell, New Jersey, in association with Mann Media Incorporated and Media Educators Association. The opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the producers, underwriters, or SiriusXM Radio. If you have any comments or questions, please email me, rmann@caldwell.edu. That's R-M-A-N-N at Caldwell, C-A-L-D-W-E-L-L.edu. I also invite you to follow me on Twitter, at Bob Mann Media. Of course, we want you to join us every week on SiriusXM Public Radio as we discuss the nation's most important and interesting media issues. But before we examine any issue, let's consider the source.